You're listening to Booth Talk from the After Movie Diner, and this is a very, very special episode, because on this episode, we get to talk to one of the stars of Ash vs. Evil Dead, the woman who would be Kelly Maxwell. Yes, that's right, the phenomenally gifted, incredible actor, very funny, warm, generous with her time. It is the person for which there aren't enough superlatives. The wonderful Dana DiLorenzo. Anyone who is even a casual visitor to the After Movie Diner website will know that we are Ash versus Evil Dead, and in fact, just Evil Dead crazy. Big fans for the last 25 years, and it has been our pleasure to cover the series throughout season two and even do a podcast on season one. So if you need to get caught up, go over to the aftermoviediner.com and then come back to listen to a phenomenal conversation with the completely and utterly awesome Dana DiLorenzo, all about making the series and her character and the strength of her character and behind-the-scenes stuff and everything you could possibly want. Anyway, I'm going to shut up now because you're going to hear enough from me during the interview. And let's hand you over to this wonderful conversation with Dana DiLorenzo.
Today.
Oh, excellent, Dana, and yourself?
I'm very well, thank you. Thanks for wanting to chat.
Oh, of course. So thank you ever so much, Dana, for being on the After Movie Diner. I'm not sure if you remember, but around the 35th anniversary of The Evil Dead, I posted an article that you and Lucy Lawless shared on Facebook about the 35 years of Evil Dead. So I just wanted to thank you personally for doing that. That was awesome.
Oh, absolutely. I remember. And I see your stuff all the time. And I thank you for all the awesome things you guys post about the show. And I read all of them. So thanks for tagging us and for talking about the show. It seems like you're enjoying it. So that makes me happy.
Oh, no, most definitely. It's our favorite show on television. I'm so proud to be able to cover it. As you can tell from the article, I've been an Evil Dead fan since I was in my early teens. So I go fairly far back with the series. So thank you again for all your support to people like us covering the show, but also just trying to put a site together and get interviews and things like that. Thanks so much for that.
Oh, well, and not to make this a love fest, but thank you, because whenever I meet fans, especially ones such as yourself who have been loyal and fans from the beginning, I mean, I really do owe you guys this job. Like, thank you for pestering, you know, Sam and Bruce and Rob for all these years to make a follow-up to Evil Dead, because of your tenacity, now here I am living my dream and get to do this job and be a part of this overwhelmingly awesome franchise. So thank you. And thank you for accepting new characters into this world that, you know, when it's really just about one lone wolf of Ash Williams. So thank you for embracing Pablo and Kelly. It's a real joy and an honor being a part of it.
Yeah. So that brings up several questions I had, but on the subject of sort of Pablo and Kelly, It makes perfect sense now, and we're embraced, as was the whole show, very, very quickly by diehard fans, certainly by us here. But when initially sort of sidekicks were announced, it can seem like it might be a bit of a gamble in terms of the franchise, only because the Ash character, as you said, is sort of so beloved and a lone wolf and so on. Were you and Ray aware of that, and did it ever influence sort of where your characters went or what they did?
I don't want to speak for Ray, but we definitely, the first time we met when it was announced that we had both gotten jobs on this, because we hadn't met prior, we hadn't even auditioned together. So when we met, you know, we had a 4-hour conversation the very first night. And part of that was discussing, you know, how this was all going to play out. And I think Ray has said in interviews that he was more confident about it. Whereas I think, I mean, I'll just be honest. I was excited and I was hopeful, especially because I had faith in the fact that continuing this franchise in a different format from what we're used to with the film. Now it's on television, so it's a different beast in a way. I did have faith in the fact that it was the original creators with the original star preserving that vision. But I would be remiss if I didn't admit that I was terrified because I was very much aware of the passion and the loyalty, as I mentioned, from the fans for this franchise. So yeah, that's a big order to ask fans to just go ahead and embrace these new characters and go with them and care about them and be on the journey with them. I mean, it could have gone a very different way. So I was very hyper aware of that. But luckily, when you have a leader like Bruce Campbell, who took us under his chainsaw wing, as I like to say, and the magnificent Sam Raimi, and of course Rob Tappert, they made us feel welcome from the start. They made us feel like we were meant to be there. And Sam gave me a pep talk straight away that made me feel like made me take a deep breath because he told me why I got the job and that I deserved it. And I just need to do what I was hired to do and let the rest fall into place. And so that's the tone that they set. So I'm grateful to them for making that the standard from the get-go. That's what the standard. I couldn't think of the word.
No, I get it.
And I'm just so grateful, you know, like now getting to talk to fans like you, and we've gotten to meet a ton of fans at Comic-Cons and conventions, and it's just so overwhelming in the best way to hear how much they love these characters and how invested they are in Pablo and Kelly. So that means the writers and the creators and the actors and all involved have done their job. So,
yeah, I mean, I think it was a very wise move. Obviously, Pablo from day one had the fact that he sort of believed in Ash and looked up to him. But it was a very smart move to sort of give Kelly that trauma initially early on in season one that then allows the audience to kind of feel for her and follow her and see her as that, as what Ash went through 30 years ago, she's now going through herself, and there being that parallel.
John, you just gave me chills, and I'm not even lying, because I have said that. I have come to that realization very late in the game that, you know what, this actually parallels Ash's journey, where in the beginning, from the first movie, he was not a badass.
No.
He was a lovable, you know, a lovable romantic guy who stood against the wall in watching in horror as his friends became possessed. He had to be tormented and tortured by evil throughout the movies to then arrive at the Army of Darkness, Ash,
yeah,
where now he's a badass with the boomstick, you know?
Yeah, of course.
And you were the only one who at least that I've done an interview with who's made that parallel as well. So good on you for that one. but I do think I agree with you, and I have said this as well. I think it was very, very smart that they knew they had to have a character to be the voice of the audience, but then it also plays with Kelly because of the trio, you know, she's the brains. She is the voice of reason.
Yeah.
So it all does make sense that way, but also I think they were very smart in realizing what makes Ash lovable and what makes Ash, partly because he's a dummy sometimes, but he's the underdog that you root for. Because why? Because he's funny and his antics are ridiculous, but he also does have this very antiquated view of women. So they, in order to still make that the joke, and I think they needed to have a character that was on his side, but would call him out on his bullshit.
Yeah.
You know, they needed a strong female character.
I actually had a question exactly about that, sort of saying how important it was to surround Ash with strong, diverse characters, especially the female characters, to kind of offset his chauvinism and his lapses into, you know, political or non-political correctness, whatever the opposite is.
Exactly. Because then you can laugh at it. It's like the show has built itself on taking the horror seriously and the comedy seriously. But the show never takes itself too seriously, just like the movies. And yeah. I love when the show like winks at the audience, like, yeah, Ash just said that. Yeah. And we're gonna call it out. So keep laughing. You know?
Yeah, no, that's fantastic.
And I love that.
It's also, I was thinking about it today when I was coming up with things to talk about with you, that certainly his chauvinism, I mean, the first movie obviously was filmed back in the late 70s when attitudes were different. But even in the first movie, there's that bit where Linda says about guessing the cards right. And Ash, who's too busy with the tape machine, goes, yeah, truly remarkable, Linda. Like, he's completely dismissive of her, even as far back as the first movie. So that has certainly been a through line of the whole series in some weird way, but I think is called out more now because of how attitudes have changed over the last 35 years.
Absolutely. And it's always funny to see, you know, a character who hasn't really changed. He is who he is, and we love him for that, but how the world around him has changed. And it's always funny to see then how people, you know, how characters within that world, you know, females, whether it's the waitress he's hitting on, or Ruby or whoever, that just like shake their head at him. But he is who he is. And I love that they still can preserve that and not, you know, we're not a PC show,
right,
but we can still adhere to what is reality right now. And I love that Kelly especially is grounded in that reality.
Oh, no, definitely. I mean, I think that Kelly and Ruby and even sort of Jill Marine Jones and Michelle Hurd in season one and season two, those characters are completely heralded and hailed quite rightly as being strong female role models and strong female characters with, you know, diverse backstories and diverse problems. And I think that it's interesting to see in a half an hour, you know, comedy gore fest format, that over the, when you step back from the 20 episodes or the 18 or 17 that we've seen so far, when you step back from that, you see that arc for all those female characters. And I think, I mean, I applaud it, but I know that lots of fans do online as well.
And I do as well. I cannot cheers the writers enough for writing strong, interesting, vulnerable, flawed female characters. And again, the fact that we even have to qualify to like to say, oh, they're writing, you know, great female characters. We should get to a point where it's just about writing a good character. But unfortunately,
I completely agree.
As the times are changing, and luckily, you know, and I like to say, especially since Xena days, I mean, Lucy Lawless was a pioneer for this kind of role, where it's just a well-written role. And it just happened to be played by a female.
Yeah.
So I hope that becomes more ubiquitous in the future, so it doesn't have to be, you know, called out as much because it's just the norm. But then I must also applaud the writers and the creators for having the gumption to do that in specifically the horror genre, which I think, you know, as we look at the history, the archetypes for these characters for females are more often than not, as we know, the damsel in distress who runs to the woods naked because she didn't have time to put on a robe, only
right,
so that she can run and trip and fall over branches. Or they're the evil ones. They're the Carries, you know.
Right.
They're the exorcists, which is great. I mean, they're all great, and they all serve their purpose. And I'm not saying one is that they're bad. What I'm saying is I'm glad we now are really forging a different archetype, a different trope for a female character that just it can be a badass, but can also be afraid, yeah. Like Kelly. Love that about Kelly, that she's not a one-note badass. I love that you see, or I love that she's not afraid to show her fear, because she's a person, you know?
Yeah.
So, yeah, when you are faced with an evil Deadite coming to throwing you against the wall or about to kill your friend, yeah, you're going to be afraid, and you're going to show that. But I love that you see her fight through that and continue to get better and better as a fighter, sticking on her feet and adapting with this. And I love that. I love playing that so much. I love going through that journey with her because my own journey as the actor playing Kelly is very similar to her.
Yeah.
You know, where I was thrown into this. I had no idea what to expect or what I was doing and if it was any good, and just getting to grow along and into this role has been one of the greatest joys of my life, truly.
Yeah, and I was going to say, the first season, Mike Watt, who is a friend of mine, also a film writer, he actually asked off the back of what you were just saying, where do you think Kelly's strength comes from? Obviously, we know that she had the trauma, so she kind of had that anger that made her step up and wanted to defeat Deadites and was initially sort of a vengeance thing. But where do you think her strength then came from within the character?
Well, I actually think it was set up very early. I mean, the very first time Kelly appears on screen on her, you know, training day as an employee at the Value Stop, you know, Ash comes up and hits on her, and she like does this, you know, a jiu-jitsu move and threatens to break his good hand, you know?
Yeah.
So I think it was from the very first moment we saw her, we saw like, oh, this is a girl you do not want to mess with. And I think that, you know, yes, she did suffer this trauma, but Kelly has always been a tough chick. She's always been honest to a fault and sarcastic and ball busting. And it's, I think where the anger or the vengeance comes from is obviously because of what happened to her in her family.
Yeah.
And also, you know, then having to be possessed and going through all of that. Like, so then when, by the time we arrive at the sixth episode of the first season in the diner, she just finally goes out of her mind with the pent up rage. And that's when she unleashes on her very first Deadite, really, that was her first kill.
Yeah.
When she uses that deli slicer and followed by the meat tenderizer.
Yeah, of course.
And I think from that point on, once she had a taste of blood, pun intended, she suddenly had this new lease on life where now, you know, she was a wild child, rock and roll rebel who now finally has found her purpose. I like to think she's always been she's always marched to the beat of her own drum. She's also always been lost a bit. And that is why, if you really want to know a little bit of backstory, that's why Kelly wears an anchor in every episode, whether it's a jewelry or a shirt, because not only does it tie into her mother, because her mother's favorite book was The Old Man and the Sea, but anchors for Kelly are huge symbols. And so that's why, in case any audience was ever wondering, that's why when we worked with Wardrobe, with our incredible designer, Barbara Dara, we knew that was very important to keep that through line. So I think that's why she cannot stop fighting. And that's why, you know, it's even been hinted at since season one. I think Pablo said it to her originally, like, do you just like not want to find the book? Do you not want us to succeed all the time so that you could just keep killing Deadites? And that's an interesting thing to ponder. If like, because if there is no evil in the world, what is Kelly going to do?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, no, definitely. And
so.
I often feel that way about the episodes that I feel like there have been enough crumbs and character points and so on throughout the 18 episodes so far that really, if the show wanted to, it could go and go and go and go and go and examine all those things. You could quite easily do a sort of 3-episode arc on Kelly coming to terms with, well, do I really want to end this once and for all and go back and sit in the sun with the gang, or do I actually prefer this situation that I'm in? So yeah, there's all those things that can be explored, which I think is great. Now, how much of that, you were giving us some backstory there, but how much of that was discussed prior to even shooting the first episode, or was it discussed kind of as the scripts came in for episodes 1, 2, and 3?
Well, you know, I feel it's part of my job as an actor to come up with the backstory for any role.
Yeah.
When I first sat down with Sam, and he told me just his thoughts on who she is, what is her, what purpose she serves within the Ghost Beaters, within the trifecta of Ash and Pablo and Kelly, what is her purpose with them and within that team? But also what drives her?
Yeah.
And so then from there, like I had already done my own, you know, work on that. And then obviously, yes, as you see what the writers give you, you use that to then inform the character and grow as the seasons go on. Actually it was very interesting. I just suggested or made a request to the wardrobe designer about like the anchor thing, because right when this job, when this audition, my very first audition for this job came up, it was a very, very difficult time for me, for a lot of reasons, but are neither here nor there. But I kept seeing anchors everywhere. And I'm like, that's so, you know, when you keep it, it's like, yeah. What is it? What is that syndrome is called? When, and it's not beta mind hop, but something where you see one thing and you keep seeing it over and over and over in the most crazy places. So I said, you know, and then when I got the job, I said, you know, just, I think this can work. If there's a way we can work it in, just for me personally and reminder as I'm playing the role, but also for Kelly. And then it turns out like the writers didn't know that at all. And then serendipitously,
yeah,
when in the second episode, when Mimi Rogers comes in and plays Kelly's mom and they do that whole, you know, dinner scene, her and Ash, and he says, what's your favorite book? She's The Old Man in the Sea. I nearly fell off out of my chair at the table.
Right.
Like, did you guys know that? Like, they're like, no. Oh. I was like, well, look, then it's meant to be. So I don't know if that answers your question, but yeah, I would say that, you know, I did my work. I got to hear what Sam, and the showrunner Craig T. Gregorio wanted, or had in mind. And then, you know, we don't really know too much. They give you broad strokes before a season, but not, I mean, all I knew was that Kelly's mom had died, and that she was going to come back from the dead. And then I knew that Kelly was going to be possessed. That's all I knew going into season one.
Right.
And season two, same thing, like didn't really know too much. So you just kind of, discuss as you go. And that's why I love this job, because, Sam set the tone, set the bar from the beginning, that it is collaborative to an extent, which it is not always the case, obviously.
Yeah.
And so I feel very grateful, that the great Sam Raimi, of all people, I mean, this is his baby, and he's the kind of person, which I think speaks to his character tremendously, that says, okay, this is what I've created, but now I want you to help me keep creating. That says it all,
yeah.
You know? And I think that is a true reason why he is one of the many reasons why he is who he is and has been successful in this business for all these years now.
Definitely, definitely. So am I right in understanding that season one was kind of shot as it was going out, but then season two was sort of all shot together before it went out? Or were they both sort of fairly shot the same way in terms of getting scripts and
plot
ups? No,
they were shot the same way.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, no,
okay.
They were, I'm sorry. Meaning like, did we filmed it all months before the first episode came out, if that's what you're asking.
Oh, right. No, because there was a lot of talk, especially with Ruby's character of the writer in the first series, of the writers sort of not really kind of putting all the dots together until halfway through. And I just wondered if that was because it was being written as you shot it rather than being all written prior.
Oh, I see. Well, yeah, and, you know, there's always rewrites and things. And when you start, you know, pulling a thread at a subplot here and there or, you know, changing things, well, that has a domino effect.
Right.
So I do think, so that is true that the writers were, you know, because even as a whole, I think while we had, you know, the producers and writers and creator had an idea of what the show was and what they were trying to achieve, you know, it took a season to really find the stride.
Right.
So I think, yes, definitely with Lucy Lawless's character, that was something that, I mean, also a testament to how incredible Lucy is, that they were going back and like reshooting stuff from, you know, a very early episode while we were also shooting the finale. And she was, you know, so she was able to inform all the different
right.
scenes, even though there was, you know, it was out of order and I'm sure very difficult to do as an actor. So that's why all praise Lucy Lawless
yeah.
for her ability to make it work. And that's, you know, that's a good actor when you just make it work. Whatever you get, you got to make it work.
No, definitely, definitely. And I also wondered if season two had longer to shoot because there seems to be far more practical effects. And I wondered whether that was because either you had more time to shoot or just simply the desire of the creative team or pressure from the fans or what was it like?
Anyway. No, actually, I believe, especially because we had Sam direct the first episode of the first season, which because he's a film director, we took the most days to shoot that episode.
Okay.
And then all the other episodes, it was kind of a rude awakening. After we shot the very first one with Sam, after that, we did each episode in a quarter of the time that we did for him. Also, though, his episode was longer than the rest.
But right.
No, I actually think season one we took, it might have been a little bit longer, if I do recall. But I'm not quite sure, so don't quote me on that. But there are a lot of practical effects in season two. And I think it's just, I don't know, again, maybe it has to do with, they were more like we knew farther in advance, or I don't know. I'm not quite sure why it seems that way, but I certainly don't know what goes on behind closed doors in terms of like, oh, well, we're going to do this. But I do know that the Evil Dead franchise is built upon
yeah.
practical effects. You have to do them. And I think what it really is, if I may express my opinion, I think that when you, because of the, how well season one was received, and it did go, you know, on quite the journey. Season two had to top it. We had to clear that bar, otherwise, it was going to fall into the curse of the sophomore slump that I hear a lot of TV shows go through.
Right.
So we had to step it up, and I've been saying this before season two came out. I'm like, man. Not only did we clear the bar, we turned it up to like season five worthy stuff all crammed into one season, you know?
Right.
So again, then now it's almost the end of the season. It's like, how are we going to top that for season three? But I have so much faith in Art and this crew and this cast. I'm not too worried that we won't.
And what's your relationship with working with practical effects?
Oh, I love it. I love it. It's obvious. I mean, way better than doing anything that would require CGI when, you know, you're looking at an X on the wall,
right,
which we
right.
have to do sometimes for some things you just can't do. But practical effects are the best because then you're reacting to the reality of what's around you. So, I love when I get to be actually terrified when I look into a deadite. Like
yeah.
the actor playing the deadite, like when they walk around at lunch and they're just sitting, you know, cause they're in, you know, hair and makeup, getting on all those prosthetics for 4 hours, 5 hours. And then, so you have it, you're on, I mean, that they're in that all day. And then they sit down across from you at lunch and they're just talking to you. And I cannot eat. I cannot look at them. I'm like, I can't even, you're too terrifying for me. I have to give props to our incredible crew, because no one even knows the hundreds of people that work on this show that, I mean, hours upon hours and weeks upon weeks of prep and the things that they do to make this show look the way it does, not only from the incredible set design, that again, the camera only captures so much. There is so much there in the world that us actors get to see that the audience never even sees, like things in drawers or a corner of this, or just the attention to detail that this crew has is remarkable. And things like, I actually just posted this on social media in the most recent episode, spoiler alert, but for 207, when we did the Asylum episode.
Yeah.
At the scene where Kelly breaks her fingers.
Yeah.
That, I just posted the time-lapse video of the process to make the mold that was my actual arm.
I saw that. It went fantastic. All the
way. Yeah. Yeah. Well, and you know, so all I had to do was sit there for 2 hours while they made a mold. They spent weeks on the rest, making the skin look right, making the nails and this, and then putting the things inside of it so that whatever the apparatus was, so that you can actually like bend the fingers all the way back. And then I'm the one who breaks it for real. Like, I got so into it that I actually broke one of the fingers. I just kept saying, I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry. I hope we got the shot.
Yeah.
Cause it doesn't work if the finger's already broken before it. But luckily it happened like after we got a couple, but even that alone, that would have never worked in any other way unless it was a practical effect.
Yeah, of course.
And again, how quick was that? That was what, 5 seconds of the episode, and people spent weeks on that one effect. I mean, that goes to show you the passion that everyone who's making this show, the passion that they have and that we all have, because, you know, you have to reflect the passion of the fans, and this whole show is a love letter to fans like you. So it's really inspiring to be around these people who everyone cares so much about what they're doing, and I think that's why the show works.
And it's an incredible blend as well of writers, writers being getting the script together, and then like a preparation time, because obviously with all the practical effects, you can't be kind of coming up with stuff on the day necessarily that require kind of big prosthetic rigs and stuff.
Right, exactly.
I have fan questions from various
sites. Oh, well, those are important. Then we have, yes, of course.
Yeah.
Of course,
John. So someone I know who reads the Bruce Campbell fan club and Ash vs. Evil Dead and so on is a big Pablo and Kelly romance fan. They want that romance. And I know some fans are desperate for it. And I'm more of the opinion that actually it, at least by episode 7 now of season 2, it works better as a sort of close, enduring friendship. What do you think?
I think it's somewhere in the middle, to be honest. I think I, too, root for them to be together because, you know, we're all hopeless romantics at heart, even as tough horror people. And at the end of the day, you root for love and you like, oh, these poor characters are going through so much, just be together and love each other. But at the same time, within this world, Pablo thinks with his heart, Kelly thinks with her head. And she realized in season 1, she even says this to him when she gets a little bit jealous of him with Heather the hiker. She says to him, you know, people get close to Ash, die. And I don't need anything else on my plate right now to add to our decreasing odds here.
Yeah.
So I think Kelly knows the minute her and Pablo get together, one of them's going to end up dead. One of them for sure. And so it's that old adage of if you love someone, let them go. But at the same time, you see, like, yeah, you call it friendship in this season. I actually think that their love's gotten even stronger. Like, especially when, you know, Pablo has that talk with her in the bar, and it really, like, hits home with her, and she gets upset about, like, oh, wow, what am I doing with my life? And then, and Kelly giving him the motivational speech when she says, there's my powerful vagina. I think that that can go either way. They could right. stay friends, you know, or, like, in extreme circumstances, they could, you know, if the plane's going down, I don't put it past them to boomstick it out. You know what I'm saying?
No, I totally understand.
So I hope we continue to keep people on their toes with it, because I think it keeps it exciting, right?
Oh no, definitely, and people are definitely loving it from the groups and things that I'm in that I see. People are loving it. So Mike Merriman says how difficult he's a friend of mine, does another show. He says how difficult was it to keep a straight face during the shotgun bong scene in season one?
You know what? This might actually shock people to hear. Ray and I have talked about that was one of the hardest scenes we ever had to do, ever. So there was no laughing. It was tough for so many reasons. But it was very tough logistically. We do move very fast on the show. So there's really no time for, like, silliness. I mean, there's, you know, everyone has a moment or, you know, have the days when we're like, what are we, you know, when Ash's head is up a cadaver's ass, of course, there's going to be giggles in between takes.
right.
But, you know, there's a lot to do in a very short amount of time. So when it came to that boomstick scene or the shotgun weed scene, first of all, smoking fake weed out of a shotgun, like that was a real shotgun that I had to smoke real fake weed out of, was just beyond awful. Like, I'd rather be covered in blood for a month straight than ever do that again.
Right.
It was like smoking the most painful incense. That's what it was, just awful.
Yeah.
And then having to do that and get a good enough rip and then I'm burning my finger and then I'm choking and I'm like, oh God, like Kelly's supposed to be this possessed badass right now. And I'm like, you know, doing that with Ray was difficult because of the placement of the shotgun and having to on the bed, off the bed, da, da, da. It was just a lot. So I think it's one of our best scenes together, if not our best, or one of my favorites so far between the two of us. But on that day, that was a long, tough day. But I'm glad that it turned out looking effortless.
No, it was fantastic. So my friend Jonesy, who asked me to tell you how amazing you were in the Asylum episode, he absolutely loved that. And wanted me to ask you if you found it challenging to do such an extreme variation from your regular role in the show. And as a second part and last part, from our Facebook page, LaRue Rue, that's his Facebook name, asks, was with Lunacy being checked off, having played crazy, do you have anything else in your acting bucket list? So I don't know if you...
Ooh, two good questions.
Okay, yeah.
Okay, so was it challenging? Yes, but I love a challenge. And it forced me to really go to some very dark places or push myself further than I have in other ways. And a lot of episodes on this show have done that, and that's why I love this job, because it's forcing me out of my comfort zone, which is usually just straight comedy. It's forcing me out of that, and I get to play and explore, and it's a dream for an actor to be able to flex muscles and see what that feels like. But because it was always a dream of mine, two bucket list things I got to cross off on this show, three, because actually one of them is coming up in the next episode. Playing possessed, have wanted to do that ever since I saw The Exorcist when I was 10. Playing a mentally insane person ever since I saw Cuckoo's Nest when I was 14. So yeah, it was a dream come true, and yes, it was a challenge, but the best kind of challenge that when you get done, you're like, oh, that felt good. Can we do it again?
Yeah, right.
I highly recommend if you're having a bad day, anybody, you don't have to be an actor. I'm saying if you're just having a bad day, just like go crazy in the mirror and like make the craziest faces or say the craziest stuff or come up with a twitch. It's just fun. It's fun to do. It gets your heart racing. And then you're like, okay, at least I'm not like that every day of my life. So I can continue now to go back to paying my bills. It's very freeing. That's what I'll say. That'll be my final note on that. It was freeing in many ways. The other question, I'm sorry.
Do you have any more on your acting bucket list?
Well, that would be sad if that was all I had. I do. I have a few more. I have quite a few more. I could go on and on forever about them. But those were just two of the longest and oldest, I would say, that have been on there forever. On my little Lisa Frank notebook paper from when I was a kid.
Maybe getting a chance to do one of your famous impressions in season 3. Maybe that should be on the list.
Maybe. Yeah, we'll just throw in a guest appearance from Miley Cyrus, but an imposter Miley Cyrus. That'd be perfect. Speaking of impressions, yeah, that's a back bucket list. I'd love to. It used to be on SNL. I don't know if that's going to ever happen, but I'd love to host it. That's been a bucket list right around the time that these other two were put on there. So, I did get to cross another one off in the next episode, and you'll know. I'm assuming you'll know exactly what I mean. So yeah. I'm smiling talking about it. Like if you can tell, it makes me giddy I'm so excited to see it.
I'm watching episode 8 tonight, so I can write my review of it tomorrow. So, I haven't seen it. I only
Your spoiler-free review. How do you do that? Spoiler-free reviews. Those are very hard to do.
They really are. I mean, I tend to just write about, as you've seen, I tend to just write about sort of the effects or the cinematography and I kind of hint at stuff for people to look forward to, but I never kind of go, oh, and in this one, you know, Ash does this or Kelly does this. But I'm not one of those people who's going to start writing about, I want the fans to see it fresh like I get to see it fresh, you know, so.
Well, I have to warn you, John, you have your work cut out for you this next one.
I can't wait.
You'll see tonight. I'm just going to be honest because there's one holy shit moment of like, oh my God. But there are quite a few things that, I mean, in its own, the episode without the big moment, it's still like there's so many things to talk about what happened.
Yeah.
So you have your work cut out for you to be able to talk about it without giving too much away. So I'm curious to see how you do that. I'm excited that you're going to be challenged. And then I want to ask you how that challenge was for you.
By all means, hit me up on social media and I'll tell you. But like on
I will.
Writing the episode where Cheryl came back and Chet dies, like how the hell, like that was... Like, how do I... Everyone
exactly.
Like, Cheryl had already been obviously kind of teased, so I could sort of talk about it and sort of say, you know, oh, that thing we were teased may or may not happen. But, Chet dying, I was, you know, I'm a huge Ted Raimi fan from way back. So, I mean, that was... he needs to come back. He needs to come back in season 3 as a whole new character because he plays, like, 15 characters in the franchise already, so...
You know what? You know what's so funny? Again, are you bugging the offices of Evil Dead or something? Because
no,
you're
just...
like on point with everything. We have been joking about because Ted, I too am a huge fan of Ted Raimi, getting to know him has been so rewarding. He is just one of the most wonderful, entertaining people I've ever met in my life. And I love the guy to death. And he is a man of a million voices. Like talking about impressions. I mean, there's beyond impressions. The man can just do any voice possible. You close your eyes, and it's like, how are you not every cartoon character on TV right now. So right. he was joking all of us, and like, because we need Ted to come back. Like, it's Ted. We're like, come on, Ted. And we're trying to figure out ways, like, how can we get away with him playing just a totally unrelated character that, but we just never make mention, like, hey, you kind of look like that Chet guy. So it's been fun, like, coming up with, oh, he can play this, or he can be this, or, yeah, because he has played, like, the most characters within the franchise.
Yeah, I mean, he plays three characters in My Name is Bruce, so I don't think that it necessarily matters. I think stick a wig and a beard on him and get him to do a Dutch accent or something. He'll
and there exactly what I echo your sentiments, my friend.
Anyway, Dana, look, it has been an absolute pleasure. You've given us loads of time. You're so generous, so wonderful to the fans. Thank you so much. And this will hopefully go out either tonight or first thing tomorrow morning, and I'll do all the usual tagging and everything. But thank you so much for your time tonight.
Beautiful.
It's been a pleasure.
Oh, John, honestly, thank you. And I'm very impressed with what you asked and where your mind's at. And it was a true pleasure talking to you. I mean, it's now been almost an hour, so clearly it's been just as fun for me. So thank you so much for your kind words and for all the ways that you write about the show and talk about the show, and especially with me and Kelly Maxwell. We both thank you, John.
Thanks, Dana. All right.
You have a good night.
You too. Bye now. Thank you.
All right. Okay. Bye-bye.
And if you've enjoyed that interview, you'll enjoy all the interviews over at aftermoviediner.com/interviews, where we've spoken to directors and actors and composers and special effects people and all sorts of people within the industry, including the cast of the original Evil Dead and Tom Sullivan, the special effects guru. Go check it out over at aftermoviediner.com/interviews. And thank you very much for listening.